sorry.
Friendly group.
Friendly group.
My name's Sheree and I'm an addict.
Hi, Sheree.
I'm really nervous. I don't know what's going to come out of this mouth, but I'm sure God will kick in and it'll be whatever's supposed to come out of my mouth. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee and Desiree for asking me to share. It's always an honor to share at any Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and this is a big honor for me. I'd like to thank those who came to support me. A lot of those people helped me to become the woman that I am today. My sponsor, my sponsee, her sponsees, my friends, and all the women who need help, because I know I do. A little bit about myself. I'm 57 years old. I thought I was 58. I can't add. I got some clarification from my sponsor this morning on that. I come from a small town. I've been clean since November 23rd of 1987. I'll be coming up on 25 years in November. I'm excited for a change. Usually it's like, you know, one day, it's just another day. And it is, it's just another day. But for me, it's kind of like a milestone because I didn't think I could get a day clean. You know, I wasn't supposed to get a day clean, I thought. You know what I mean? I come from a family of eight. I lost two brothers to an active addiction. I had issues like Kleenex tissues. At five, I was molested by a family member, a cousin. I thought I would never share that with anyone. But when I came here, I found out that I wasn't unique in anything that happened to me or that happens to me along the road to recovery. It happened again at 9 years old. My brother's best friend. I never told anyone until I got clean. I heard a lady tell my story, and that made it okay for me to tell somebody finally. And that kind of made me feel different. I felt dirty. I felt useless. I felt like, well, I was already feeling different from my family anyway. I was the only left-handed person. I wasn't as pretty as my sisters. I wasn't as smart as my brothers. My teeth stuck out. My brothers and sisters always called me names, so I felt different. I felt like they didn't like me very much. You know what I mean? They all had a bike, and I didn't have a bike, and I kept holding on to that for years. It's like, well, why didn't I get a bike? Why didn't I get treated like everybody else? Why didn't I have what everybody else had? And I've learned that it is what it is. I felt like my mother didn't love me. I know she did today, to the best of her ability. I need to say I miss her. She died in 1994. My daughter did get to meet her. They told me I would never have children. That was one of those good reasons I had to use. You know what I mean? I was married. I had, you know, that wonderful little plan. You know, graduate from high school, meet a wonderful person. College never entered the thought of my mind. Get married. I met my husband when I was 15. I was married by the time I was 17. I was in an active marriage for 23 years. I'm divorced from that person. But we make the best of friends today. That's God in this fellowship. He's in this fellowship too. He just celebrated 19 years on the 20th of this month. I used because I couldn't have kids. I used because I didn't feel like everybody else. I used because it was Monday. I used because everybody wasn't around and I could use in peace. I thought, you know, I used because I wanted to use. Today I don't want to use. I know that no matter how different we are individually, we're all the same because we're all here for the same reason. I want to stay clean one day at a time, and I want to keep staying clean one day at a time. I want to die clean if possible, you know what I mean? Long as I don't use, and sometimes that's more than a chemical. Sometimes that's sex. Sometimes that's food. Sometimes that's shopping. Sometimes that's TV. Sometimes that's feelings that don't kill you, but they'll have you do some things if you don't recognize what you're going through. So in that case, what I do is I work steps. You know what I mean? 1 through 12. I don't graduate. I get to work them again. 1 through 12. Still don't graduate. I get to work them again. 1 through 12. Still no graduation. I believe that the longer I stay clean, the more things get revealed to me, you know, through working the steps and the traditions. When I came around, you worked the steps. You did all the steps first, and then you did the traditions. Now they kind of do them hand in hand, and I don't know how that works, because that's not how it was given to me. I can only give it to you the way it was given to me. I do not like the step working guide. That's just my personal belief. It's redundant. It's I just don't like it. But I'm using it now. You know, I'm using that the third time around working steps. I'm using the step working guide because I need to keep an open mind. I need to be open to what that book has to offer. I struggle with it. I fight with it. And it's funny, my sponsor didn't make me do it. She asked me when I was ready to work my steps again. She said, well, which way do you want to do it? Well, I've done it through the basic test a couple times. She said, okay, you still didn't tell me what you wanted to do. I said, I guess it's time to try the step working guide. So I have, and I've been on one step particularly of a long, long time, and I came up here to do it with my sponsor, and I couldn't find it. I couldn't find it. It was at home, you know. But anyway, I came from the marriage. I got married when I was 15. I found out I couldn't have kids. I mean, 17. I found out I couldn't have kids. I started using at that age. I started with the usual stuff, the beer, the alcohol, went to pills, went to weed, ended up with freebasing. And for some reason, I distinguished between freebasing and smoking crack. I guess because it was done differently when I got high, but it's still the same damn thing, you know. Where it took me was some really dark places. Where it took me was to a fearful place that I couldn't crawl out of. It took me to abandoned houses. It took me to a house that was decent, and by the time I left it, it was tore down. It took me to stealing and lying and not being able to hold on to a job. It took me to tricking myself, not in the street, but I was tricking my husband to get the drugs that I wanted. Tricking's tricking. It doesn't matter if you do it in the street and you don't know the person, or if you do it to your next door neighbor, and who cares? I cared. And when it got to that point, I was starting to think maybe something's wrong. You know, just maybe, you know. But my ex was an addict also. So in 1987, he went to a rehab, and 4 days later, I went to a rehab because I couldn't do it anymore. I stayed clean. He did not. It took me 4 years of being clean to leave the relationship, and I didn't leave it because I didn't love him. I left that relationship because I couldn't, because I became abusive to my husband, bottom line. I would start kicking him. He would, like, hide in the house and get high. It's like, what are you doing hiding in the house? I can't get high in peace. You bother me. And he was right. I wasn't going to let him just get high in the house. Those were my boundaries. You're going to kill yourself? You go out there and kill yourself. Don't come in here. I'm trying to stay clean. And I'm trying not to be mean. And I'm trying to help you, and you won't let me. See, I'm all about helping somebody. But today, along with helping somebody, I'm helping myself. And I'm learning that. I'm a caregiver by nature. But I've drawn some boundaries because I've been through some stuff. After I divorced my husband, then I met my daughter's dad, you know, baby daddy. I got a baby daddy. And he gets on my nerves, too. We try to be friends, but he tries to still do the same thing he does, and I ain't got time for that either. And then I was in a relationship with a person for 12 years. He came into my life. He was in recovery. I was in recovery. We were both trying to raise kids. I had my daughter. She was all of 4. He had his son. He was 2. I saw that he was a pretty decent dad with his son. So I said, oh, he might be quality. Okay. So we hooked up, and we were careful. We just kind of dated for a long time. The kids didn't know for a while. Finally, we incorporated the kids into it, and he moved in, and we coexisted. And, you know, I tell people, this is my significant other, you know, and it was an in-and-out relationship. It was horrifying. It was what I allowed it to be. He was in and out of the rooms. He had, when I first met him, he was a year clean. And then the next year, he relapsed, and he was 2 weeks short of a year clean. Then it was 2 months short of a year clean. Then it was 2 hours, from a year clean. And then he started stealing stuff from the house. You see, I let this happen. I need to tell you, I let this happen. He can't walk out of the house without something if I don't let him. I took keys. He was climbing through the windows. I locked doors. I was sick. I was very sick. I was having a gastric bypass, and I got really sick and had to go back to the hospital. When I came back home from the hospital, I couldn't get in my house. He drilled holes in the door so I couldn't use the keys to get in my own house. Thank God I had one of my sponsees with me, and her son was with me. They picked me up from the hospital, and he climbed up. I said, I know he went through the window. There was one window in my house that didn't lock. I know he climbed through the window and locked himself in there and drilled the door shut, and I had him climb through the window, and he came down through the basement. That's how I knew he couldn't get the doors open. The only one he didn't lock was the basement door, and it was like, you got to go. He wouldn't leave. You got to go. He wouldn't leave. Another year or so, I hung in there praying, and controlling, and praying, and hoping he would stop the madness. I should have been praying that I would stop the madness. So, at that point, I was sponsoring a few women, and I picked up a new sponsee. And I'm the type that, you know, I get a new sponsee, I like to spend a lot of time so I can find out who they are and what they want from me and what I want from them and that kind of stuff. And this girl went everywhere with me, on vacation, on everything. And the bottom line was that sponsee left with my significant other. I was in a fetal position for a year, maybe a year and a half. Everybody tried to talk to me. Everybody loved me as much as I would let them. But it was hard. It was really hard. I was like, how dare he do this to me? How dare she do this to me? You know what I mean? I ended up going to, she filed false charges on me several times. I was in a magistrate's office 3 times, false charges. I got enough of that. This program taught me I ain't got to fall for everything. So I scraped some money together, and I got a lawyer, and it's like, I need these charges dropped, because I ended up having to go to Pittsburgh to court again. Harassment of her, harassing her children. I didn't even care. Here's what I told her when I found out. See, this is me, the caretaker in me. I'm still sponsoring her. Look, we can work through this together. You don't have to do what you always did. You don't always have to take somebody else's man. I will work with you. We will work together, or you're going to be dead to me. I have nothing ever further to say to you ever again. She didn't say anything, so she became dead to me. I didn't bother her. That's when she started getting angry because I wasn't feeding into her madness. I would be driving, and she would holler out, you B, you cunt, you this, you all the names that normally would make me want to fight. But see, I had this program all wrapped around me. I had my sponsor, my sponsees, my friends, my God, wrapped around me to keep me from killing her and him. I went, and I was going to buy a taser. I was going to do somebody in. I got some pepper spray. They started harassing my daughter. Oh, now we got a problem. Okay, my daughter has nothing to do with this. You want me? Come for me. Leave my daughter alone. My daughter would be trick-or-treating. They'd be riding around in the car harassing my daughter in her Halloween costume. It's like, see, now you're going to have a reason to take me to jail. Okay? But they moved. They moved out of state. I'm so happy. You know what I mean? I don't care if they lived there forever. I just want you to leave me alone. As long as they were living in the same town I was living, they would not leave me alone. We were always running into each other, and I would never say anything to them. They would say obscene stuff in meetings. There's that no good bee, and she's this, and she's that, and he's my man now. What do you think about that? And I would just walk right past them. God gave me strength to just walk right past them. My sponsee family and everybody just kind of rallied around me. For a while, I had a guard dog. That one right there. She's I'm coming to meetings with you, Mom. This is not going to happen. I'm going to beat somebody up. No. No. But she did. She went to every meeting with me, and she made sure I got in the car, and she made sure I got home. And thank you, Dawn. I love you. I love you a lot. And my sponsor would call me, and she'd say, okay, what did they do now? What them crazy people do now? Thank you, Jeannie. But it's in the past now. I've moved on. I don't have anybody in my life to cause me that kind of pain no more. I've been free and single for 5 years now, about 5 years. I like it. I like not having to cook and clean for nobody but me and my daughter. I like that I can come and go as I please. I like that I don't have to answer to anybody but God. I like it. I like it. I like it. It's taught me, because I was so codependent, that I can take care of myself no matter what I got to do. Long as it's, you know, I'm on disability, and I've been on disability for 10 years. I'm sorry, disability doesn't pay all the bills, ladies. If you're ever thinking about going on it, know that disability does not pay all the bills. It just doesn't. So what I do is, I can't do too much. I have screws in my ankles. I have arthritis in my knees. I have degenerative joint disease in my hips. I'm in pain a lot of times, but I can drive. And what I do is I drive 16 hours a day, a lot of days. But you know what? It pays the bills. My daughter is in college now. I'm so proud of her. I don't like her most of the time. She's 19. She's opinionated. Nothing I say is right. We argue. We battle. Sometimes like two grown women. Sometimes. But I know she loves me, and I love her, and I'm really proud of her. I told her she wants to be a film director. I said, okay, but you better have a backup. Okay, please have a backup. So photography is like her backup thing. She can do a lot with that. She's going to do an internship with a couple photographers, friends of mine. But life ain't easy. It's not easy. Just because you get some time, it just makes it just a bit harder, because acceptance is the key. And for me, acceptance comes in stages. It comes like I'll say it for a while, and I don't even really know what it means. And then I'll start feeling like I accepted certain things, but I still have the pain. And I know that I've accepted something when it don't ball me up anymore. I know that I've accepted something when I ain't crying and I'm not knowing what's going on in between the hormonal rages and all that good stuff that we have to go through. I just wish men had to do that one time. Just one time. Even have a baby. Just have one time. I had one. I didn't want no more. But my daughter and I live together. She is in school. We have arguments almost daily, but I know she loves me, and she knows I love her. I drive. She always needs something. She works. You gonna get a job, girlfriend. I ain't got it to do no more. You're 19. And guess what? Once you work, you never stop until you can't work anymore. She knows that. She doesn't like that, but she knows that. Like, she's home working right now. She wanted to come. She's like my third leg. She usually goes everywhere I go. She knows she's an NA baby. She knows everybody in NA, and they know her. But we coexist in a house. Our bills get paid. I don't go to a lot of meetings anymore. I talk to recovery people every day. I have to work. I have no choice. I have to work. I was talking to somebody earlier, and she had asked me a couple things. I said, I don't go to a lot of meetings anymore. On a good week, I get to two, and that's just being honest. And on a bad week, I get to one, and on a real bad week, I don't go to one for a couple of weeks. But I know what to do. Mm-hmm. I know what to do. I think if you're you have a lot of clean time, more than 15 years or so, that I don't have to live in N.A. anymore. I need to go out there and do life and do what N.A. gave me to survive and to live. I'm not surviving anymore. I'm living. And I have a good life. I take care of everything myself. I have a 3-bedroom house and 2 cars that I take care of. Me, God, and my daughter. You know what I mean? And that's all that matters to me. Sometimes I don't know what I'm feeling. Sometimes I don't know where I'm at. Sometimes I don't like to answer my phone, but I do. It's like people say, well, just turn off the phone. I can't because nobody turned their phone off for me. I take calls in the middle of the night, but there better be something real wrong with you. Okay, real wrong. Don't call me talking about I can't sleep. I was. You know what I mean? But I take phone calls in the middle of the night. I have no problem doing that. I do service work. I love to do service work. I'm involved. I've been involved in service since day one. I do maybe 5 years. And I'll take a year's break, and I'll go and do 5 or 6 more years, and I'll take a year's break. I'm doing this year. I'm finished this year, and I'm taking another break because I've been doing it for a couple years now, and I'm going to take a break. I do something real simple, something that I can do that doesn't demand a whole lot of me, and I sell literature because I think it's important. I think it's very important. I have 2 home groups. One I'm not active in at all. I joined that home group so that I could do service in that area. I go to it, but I don't go to it regular at all. The other home group is the home group I've had since the day I got clean, and it'll always be my home group. But I believe in the Southwest area. It struggles. They have their problems. Either they'll get over them or the area will dissolve. That's the bottom line. You know, that's the bottom line. I don't want it to dissolve. I don't want it to disappear. So I keep coming in there and I keep trying to help. And they keep telling me, oh, that's how they used to do it. Okay. That's kind of like, it worked for years. Why won't it work now? You know, but that area is unique in the fact that there's something there called Monyok. It's a mental health agency. And I don't know nobody in that area that does area service that ain't taking a pill for something. Okay, including myself. But they have GSRs that are 30 days clean, and they have, you know, it's just like they're struggling. You know, they're struggling for some support, and nobody gives them support. Now they go, some of them go to meetings out everywhere, like Rochelle. She goes to meetings everywhere. I go to meetings everywhere and anywhere. They stay in that little cocoon of meetings, and that's why they don't grow. And I try to tell them, go out. The broader the base, the higher the point of freedom. They don't. So that, I don't give that area too much longer, but I'm going to stay there till it's gone. Know that. I'm going to stay there till it's gone. If you're struggling with anything, man, child, dog, cat, that's where you're supposed to be. Okay? If you don't know what to do do nothing. Okay? If you do know what to do and you're afraid, ask for help. It's here. All you have to do is pick up the phone. I know somebody in here got somebody else's phone number. I know, because if your sponsor didn't teach you that, she didn't teach you the right thing. Get a sponsor that works for you. Stay close to your sponsor so you can fly yourself. I still hang on to my sponsor when I can get her. You know what I mean? It's like, I still want what she has. I ain't got it all. I ain't got nothing going on. All I got is a few days more clean than you. And if you woke up before me, you're a head start. A head start. If nobody has told you today that they love you, I do. Thank you for being here for me. Thank you for allowing me to share. And I'm so glad this is over. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Okay, our next speaker is Cheryl L. from Frick Park 12 and 12. Did I get that one right?
Okay.
Okay.
I'm an addict named Cheryl.
Cheryl.
Oh, I just need to breathe for a second. I was sitting there listening to Cherie and nodding my head, you know, to all the things that I could relate to. And then kind of sitting there and hearing some of the things that weren't part of my story. Some of the things that she said truly were part of my story. And some of them are things that I've never experienced before. And that's the miracle to me of this fellowship, is that we come here from different walks of life, different religious backgrounds, different races, totally different experiences. And if I'm willing to listen with an open heart, I can hear not just the experiences of another woman that I can relate to, but the emotions of another woman that I can relate to. And, so often, I can sit in a meeting and somebody can, share their experience, which is not anything that I've experienced. But when they share the feelings that go with that experience, wow. Like, that's what matters in here, is not whether I did what you did, whether my experience is identical to yours. What allows me to receive the help available in here is my ability to, like, open myself up to the emotions of another human being and say, wow, I felt that too. Wow, I know what that feels like. Or, shit, I'm feeling that now and I don't know how to get through it. And it doesn't have to be, the same external experience that I get. It's when we have that same internal experience that I really gain something from this. I was up in the Laurel Mountain area for an event, and Edgar came up to me and said, hey, and he had this little sheet out, and he was like, you're willing to speak at our retreat? And I was like, sure, yes, of course, I'd be honored. And in my head, I got to be real, in my head, I'm thinking, all right, I'm going to spend the week before getting ready to go camping, getting everybody together, doing all the shopping, doing all of this, and it'll be great, because I'll have all my people here with me. So, just so you know, 3 weeks ago, reality set in, and I determined that I am not Superwoman. My sponsor said, no shit, about time. And I looked around at the things that were going on in my life, and I said, there's no way, I can plan to do this camping thing that we do with, 50 of our closest friends. So I said, I pretty much put it out there, I'm not doing this. If you guys want to go, it'll all be, it'll all work out. And I was still intending at that point that we were going to come up on Friday and be camping, just my family, and that didn't work out. My daughter had a gymnastics meet this morning, so that meant we didn't come up and camp yesterday. And my husband has a service commitment tomorrow, so we're not camping tonight. So nothing about being here was anything the way I thought it was going to be. And, I had to be willing to just, let go and be like, okay, it will be what it's supposed to be. And Cherie was talking about all of her people that came with her and were here to support her. And I got out of the car and my daughter said, do I really have to go sit in the meeting? I was like, no, you don't have to. I'd like it if you would, but no, you don't have to. Apparently, she found something better to do. And my husband's not here because it's the women's wrap. And so I came up with Desiree, and there was nobody really here. And then, hugged a couple people who were here, and they were people I know. And it was like, okay, it's okay. And then Carol Lee came up, and I don't have to. That's the crazy thing. I have to bring my people with me because my people are always here. I've been around this fellowship long enough that I don't really go anywhere where I don't know somebody. And that's that miracle. And the other side to that is I could literally end up in a meeting where I don't really know anybody, meaning I've never met them before, have no idea who they are, know nothing about them, and I still know them. And like, once I'm willing to let go of all of that, I've never seen you before, and meet somebody on that spiritual level, we know each other. You know, it's that I was in Harrisburg not that long ago, and went to go find a meeting, and so it was in this big building that had 87 doors. You know those buildings that we meet in that have 87 doors and 50 things going on at the same time, and like you kind of walk around the door and you look at the people and it's like, nope, that's not where I want to go. And you go, there's my people. Like we just know. You know, open my heart and I just know, and that's, you know, that's what this fellowship does for me. So I said yes to Edgar that I would come up here and speak, and he said, you're speaking on something called the women's wrath. He says, I don't know what the hell that is, but some people have been asking us to have it, so we're having it. And I looked down at his paper that he had it written on, and it said, women's wrap, WRAP. So I thought, damn, like I should come up, you know, I need to bring some wrapping paper, some boxes, and then I'm thinking, okay, wrap, the women's wrap, all right. You guys don't want to hear me. I wrote a few rap lines in my head, but I'm not sharing them with you. Because I'm going to be honest. I had never attended a women's rap until the spiritual retreat this year. And the only reason I went was because one of my sponsees was speaking. What I've been told the women's rap is, and I, you know, this is what I hear. This is where we as women get raw and real and raunchy and talk about the shit that we don't talk about when men are around. Well, there's really nothing anymore that I don't talk about with men around. And I don't really get raunchy anymore because that's not part of who I am anymore. I can get real and I can get raw, but I don't need to get raunchy. I can talk about sex without dropping the F-bomb 82 times. You know, I don't need to be that girl that I was when I got here. So I have no idea what's going to come out. What I want to tell you, I don't know if any of you have this experience, but when I'm naked in the shower with shampoo in my hair, I really, really know how to carry the message. Okay, so I'm telling you, the soap, the razor, the conditioner, they got the message this morning. I don't know what you guys are going to get. It was damn good in the shower this morning. See, now, if I had been camping, I wouldn't have been in the shower, so all of that would have been stocked up just for you. But because I was home, the soap got it all. You know, I was listening to Cherie, and probably one of the first things that she said that had me nodding my head in recognition is being told that you can never have a child. At 16 years old, I was given, you know, one of those slim and none and slim left chance of having a baby. And truth be told, I took that information and I, you know, when I think back to being a little girl, I remember being 5 or 6 years old on the side of my house. We lived in a duplex and my best friend was our landlord and they lived upstairs and we lived downstairs and we had a rose of Sharon bush and we used to pull the flowers off before they bloomed and we would open them ourselves because we were like so eager for them to open. And I remember being like 5 or 6 years old and talking with my best friend Rosemarie, and we had these little girl dreams. We were going to go to college together and be roommates, and we were going to meet best friends and marry, and we were going to have our kids together. And the truth is, I don't ever remember a time in my life that I didn't want to be a wife and a mother. Like, I don't remember a time that wasn't part of my dream. I remember there was a time when I stifled that dream. My parents got divorced when I was 7, and I probably know a little more information about that than I should have. And maybe not that I should know now, but I think I knew it way earlier in my life than I should have. And one of the things was that my mother wanted to go back to work after I was in school. I was the baby. And my father apparently had this like idea that no wife of his was going to work. And that was the early 70s. And all my mother wanted to do was to be able to be an independent woman. And as I was growing up and wanted to be a wife and a mother, I felt fear in expressing that because she had divorced and fought and did all of these things to be able to be an independent woman. And I felt like saying I wanted to be a wife and mother was like slapping her in the face. And so there was this kind of breakdown of communication there. And it was a breakdown of communication that I never got an opportunity to fix. My mother passed away when I was 16. And I lost a baby that same year. I miscarried, and that was not confirmed until I was in my 20s. And that was pretty much at 16 what they had told me was that I had a slim chance of getting pregnant, and if I did get pregnant, I'd have a slim chance of carrying a child to term. I got pregnant, I miscarried. That pretty much told me that was what it was about, and that kept me using. I picked up my first drug alcohol at about knee-high to a grasshopper. If my parents had parties, I was the kid going around drinking everything that everybody left, and everybody thought it was funny. I started using in a way to change how I felt at 11. And by 12 years old, I had written in my journal, I was an avid journal keeper. In my journal, I had written on my 11th birthday, 1977, my 11th birthday. So I picked up when I was 10. My 11th birthday, I'd written in my journal about this cute boy. His name was Brian Romero. And I wasn't going to get to see him because I had fallen down the stairs and hurt my foot, and I wasn't going to school, and I thought maybe I'd get a birthday kiss from him at 11. Okay. That was my 11-year-old fantasy. 6 months later in my journal was this entry about how wasted I had gotten, about some things that I had done, some harm that I had caused to my close friends, and it said, I'm not going to do this anymore. And then it skipped two lines and said, I don't think. So, July of 1977, I was 11 and a half years old and caught up in the grips of addiction to the point that I was causing harm to people I loved and already, like, didn't think I could stop doing what I was doing. You know, I think the some of where our addiction takes us really has a lot to do with where we are when we start. I lived with my mother in Southern California. My father and my brothers lived on the East Coast. I don't think that had I stayed living with my dad that I wouldn't have been an addict. I just think some things might have been a little different. But I used every day. Ultimately, I was 12 years old and I ran away from home over something so stupid that I don't even remember what it was, but I pretty much said to my mom, well, no, I didn't say. She grounded me. I jumped out the second story window, had her panicked that I was, you know, on the streets injured, managed to get somewhere, managed to get somebody to call my father, managed to get my father to call somebody. My mother's combing the streets looking for her injured child, and I'm on a plane. Because my father's answer was, you just come here. That was probably like my first attempt to stop my addiction at 12, and that didn't work. I got to New York with my dad, and I just found different ways and means and different things to use. That wasn't, you know, that was one of those, that wasn't any different. I don't know, children of divorce, the grass is kind of always greener on the other side, so I end up in New York with my dad, who I had only ever spent holidays and summers with, where it was always fun. I love my dad, but he was a bit of a perfectionist. And so, like, the story that always stands out about my relationship with my father was I was struggling in math. And, I mean, that's one of the things I got to say, like, in spite of my active addiction, I managed to get through high school and through college. But I was struggling in math, and I think I'd gotten a C on my report card, which was completely unacceptable. I'd gotten a 97 on a test after I had just gotten a C on the report card, and I put it up on the refrigerator. And I know it was a Thursday because my dad worked late on Thursday night, I was usually in bed before he came home. So I put it up on the refrigerator for him to see. And when I got up in the morning, the note on my 97 was, why wasn't it 100? And ultimately, for most of my life, my relationship with my father is, I'm never going to be good enough for him. As he's well in his 80s now. I don't know that it's changed, but how I relate to him and how I relate to that relationship has changed. So I no longer hear everything that he says to me as, you're not good enough. You know, and it makes me think that probably for a lot of those years, what he thought he was saying to me and what I was hearing were two very different things. But ultimately, my father was trying to hold me to task for a lot of things, and I didn't like it there. So under the guise of all little girls should be with their mommy, and not very well communicated, I had this deceptive plan that I was going to go off to summer camp. And from summer camp, I was going to write my father a letter to say, I'm moving back with mommy, and get on a plane. Like, I couldn't even say to my father, Dad, I don't want to live here anymore. I want to go back to my mom. Well, obviously, we didn't have a very trusting relationship. And at some point, I guess he was searching my room for something, and he found my journal that said that that was my plan. And he pretty much then said, you know what? If that's what you want to do, then to school, I'll put you on the plane. Let's start packing. Like, he wasn't fighting me on it. Like, no matter what I did, no matter what I used, no matter what wrong boy I brought home, he loved me, and he really only wanted what was best for me, and he had no clue. You know what? I'm a mother. I make decisions for my daughter every day that I think are what's best for her. Honestly, I have no clue. Like, in the moment that I make the decision with the information I have, I do what I think is best. My father did the same thing. I know that he put me on that plane saying, this is what she wants and this is what I'm going to do, but I know he didn't really believe in his heart that it was what was best for me. He knew that my mother didn't supervise me well. He knew that the lifestyle in California was what I was going back to chase. But he let me do what I needed to do. You know, the unfortunate thing is, or fortunate, one of the things that I've come to understand today as a result of recovery is that Most of the time I get to figure out and attribute the meaning to things after it happens. And I can be in the middle of what feels like the worst thing in the world. Some cross path or something. And in the middle of it, it's like, this sucks. This is the worst thing that could happen. But what that brings me to is something totally different. So, you know, I never know how to think about this. I went back and, you know, I thought I was going to get to have this amazing relationship with my mother. And, you know, I don't even know what kind of dreams I thought were going to happen there. And things were, I mean, in a lot of ways, things were better than when I left at 12, only because I was 14 and things were a little different. But it was cut short. I was there 2 years. My mother remarried. I have a stepfather who all of these years later I'm still close to. He has a new wife. I don't even know, like, I don't even know what to call my mother, my deceased mother's husband's wife. Like, I don't know what to call her. I call her Madeline. That's her name. But I have a relationship with this woman who, to her, I'm her husband's dead wife's daughter. Like, as a result of being in recovery, I can have relation. I don't need to label every relationship. I can meet a person where they are and make a definition. You know, in so many ways, like, my mother's death was the worst thing that happened to me. And in so many ways, my mother's death was the best thing that happened to me. I got clean for the first time. My mother died on April 4th. My very first clean date was April 10th of 1982. I was 16 years old. I won't say I stayed clean for 2 years, but I stayed abstinent for 2 years. And I really believe today those 2 years of abstinence were probably a saving grace for me. Because if I had continued using, I think I would have been dead. I'd had some suicide attempts. I had, you know, some crazy behavior. But what happened is I ended up having to come back to live with my dad. And I pulled it together. Like, I stayed clean. I went to college. I relapsed. I loved, you know, my relapse story, nothing really exciting. Some older guy took me to Atlantic City. I was 18, not 21. And the cocktail waitress said, "What'll you have?" And I said, 7 and 7. And I was spending somebody else's money. And she didn't ask me for ID. And I don't remember anything. Linda Ronstadt came down on a quarter moon. That's all she wrote. Next morning, my head was in the toilet. When they say you pick up where you left off, I would have, you know, thought, okay, that had been it. I started all over again. You know, I don't even know what I want to say here. I got clean shy of my 22nd birthday. I'm 46 now. You know, I had this miraculous year, the year that I celebrated 11 years clean. I had, you know, started using pretty much at 11. I'd used for 11 years, and I had 11 years clean, and my daughter was born. Like, that was, like, I decided to identify that as a miracle year. And that's what I find today, is that I get to experience things, and I get to label them. Like, I don't need the labels that other people put on things. You know, the relationships that I've had since I got clean. Let me talk about sponsorship for a second, because that's what's in my head right now. You know, my very first sponsor was a woman named Gladys, and I asked her to be my sponsor because you guys told me to get a sponsor who had what I wanted. You know what Gladys had? Right? Remember, little girl who just wanted to be a wife and mother? Gladys had a husband and 2 kids. I can't tell you what kind of recovery program Gladys worked, but I knew that Gladys had a husband and 2 kids. Gladys was my sponsor for about my first 90 days. A little bit of the fog cleared when I had about 90 days, or somebody smacked me upside the head. I'm not exactly sure what. And I got a little bit of an idea that what you said, what you meant when you said, has what you want, wasn't a material concept, but a more spiritual concept. And I asked a woman named Regina to be my sponsor. And when I say Regina was a beautiful woman, I don't just mean what she looked like. Let's just start with physically, Regina was a beautiful woman, and she was the kind of woman that when she walked by, everybody's head turned. But what really made her so beautiful was who she was on the inside, her giving spirit, her love of life, the way she carried herself. This was one of those crazy things. So shortly after she became my sponsor, so she had, and this is one of those things that's weird too, like she had 3 years clean when she was my sponsor, and like 3 years clean was a whole lot of clean time. Like she had like the most clean time of anybody in the area where I got clean. And she had 3 years. And she had 3 years clean, and this sounds crazy. She was getting a new bed. I was like, Gina, why are you getting it? You have this perfect, she had, you know, one of those canopy beds with the mirror on the top and all of that. And I thought it was the most awesome bed in the world, right? Who would want a bed with a mirror, right? Right? Because of the lifestyle I was living, bed with a mirror. Gina was getting rid of that bed because of that mirror. Because of what she had seen and what she had done, and that wasn't the woman she was. That floored me. Like that idea of I can get rid of things. I can get rid of things that aren't about who I am or who I want to be. And she was the first person to teach me that, like, not just in the material world of you could get rid of that, but that her getting rid of that was a symbol of getting rid of who she had been, not who she was becoming. And she was my sponsor for probably the first almost 3 years. And we did step work together. She was the person. One of the things that I remember early on in her sponsoring me was she asked me what I wanted from the relationship with her. I was 90 days clean. I was freaking clueless. But regularly, she would just kind of do a check-in with me and say, what do you want from this relationship? I learned from her that the way to have what I want in any relationship is to find out, number one, what the other person wants in it, and tell them whether or not I'm capable of doing that, and on the other side, say, this is what I want. Well, I've ended a whole bunch of relationships because if I ask that question, and what you want and what I want are two different things, I don't need to continue. Damn. I get to choose who I have relationships with today. I learned that from my sponsor. So what I've done is now anytime somebody asks me to sponsor them, I say the same thing. I said, I'm willing, but you need to figure out what it is that you want from a sponsor, and we need to then talk about whether that's something I could give you. It's been so effective. She and I had, the other thing that I learned from Regina is that I can have a parting of ways with somebody and not end a relationship. Like, we had gotten to a place when I had about 3 years clean that the direction her life was going in and the direction my life was going in was very different. We changed our relationship. I got a new sponsor. That didn't mean I didn't still have a relationship with her. It just changed. And I learned how to negotiate those changes. And that was really cool. The woman that I got to sponsor me, and I need to kind of like revisit this, is I was getting to that place where my biological clock was ticking again, and I was having some female health issues that needed to be addressed that also connected to whether or not I could or couldn't have children. And I was up at the Tri-State Spiritual Retreat, and there was a woman speaking, and I don't even remember what she was speaking on. All I know was that she was up there sharing about the work that she had to do to have a complete hysterectomy at 27 and trying to figure out what it meant to be a woman if she couldn't have children. The words that she said was exactly what I was feeling. Was like, if I can't have children, what does it mean to be, like, I define being a woman as being a mother. And what would happen if that couldn't happen? And I ended up getting her number, talking with her, asking her to be my sponsor. She was my maid of honor at my first marriage. That one didn't last real long. But the really cool thing was that she found this prayer in this prayer book that had been my mother's, that I had just like had but never looked at, that was called the prayer for the motherless, with the motherless wife. But she found it in there and helped me to like get okay with who I would be if I never had children. You know, and that's one of those things where I believe that people are placed in my life, and they're placed there, they come to be there, and I get to take, you know, I get to take advantage of that, and so do they. The other person who was in my life at that time, and this is one of those strange things, I had a sponsee who was the same age that my mother would have been, that I sponsored. And we had this really unique relationship because while I was her sponsor, she was a surrogate mother to me. And ultimately, she ended up dying of the same cancer that my mother died from. And people said all sorts of bizarre things, well, that I think are bizarre. I'm sure they thought it made perfect sense. But I had people say, oh, well, maybe this is happening so that you can make peace. And I'm like thinking, I can't believe in any kind of higher power that would make somebody suffer so that I could get peace. But the truth is, I was able to use that time. I was able to be there for my sponsee in a way that I had not been able to be there for my mother. And I was able to gain some peace from that. I was able to make some amends through that. I was able to make some amends to me through that. But I was also able to celebrate somebody's life in a way that I didn't know how to do in active addiction. And so that was that, you know, other miracle there. The relationships that I have with women today are just amazing. I don't know about you, but when I was using, the way I identified, you know, women was as competitors, right? So if I walked into a bar, I looked at each one of you and figured out, you know, who I had to, you know, updo, if you will, so that I was the person getting bought the drink, or so that I was the person who could snuggle up to the dope dealer. I mean, that was the way I lived. Today I can look around a room of women and look for who's somebody that I can connect with. Who's somebody that I can share something with? Who's somebody who has something to offer? I can look around and say, these are my sisters, not these are my competitors. And like, that's a big, you know, a big change. One of the things that I think I told the soap this morning, you know, is this whole idea that, you know, the idea that somehow the women's rap is where we get to say all the things that we can't say in front of men, or that men wouldn't understand, is I sometimes think we do ourselves a disservice as women when we think that the men in our lives wouldn't understand this. You know, there's all those books out there about how we think differently than they do, and I'm not saying we don't, but if we just give everything up to, well, they think differently, so we're not going to be on the same page. My daughter's 14 years old. Apparently, according to my doctor, I've been in perimenopause since she was two. Please, God, let this end, okay? I've done hot flashes, night sweats, not being able to sleep, sleeping all the time, bleeding for 13 days straight, not getting a period for 6 months, you know, like, please make it go away. Oh, sex? What's that? Right? I don't know. They keep telling me when this ends, I'll want it all the time again. Can I get there, please? My doctor said something about, well, what are you doing for birth control? I said, do I need it? Like, yeah, like, oh my God, you know, like, she said, and your husband stands for that? I said, well, you know, all I can do is talk with him about what I'm going through, and that it's not that I don't love you, it's not that I don't want you, it's not anything, it's like my body's screwed up, and I can say to myself, want to have sex. Want to have sex. I can put sexy movies on. Like, and then I get a period. Like, I want to have it, and then I get, oh my God. Like, you know what? But it doesn't matter. Like, if I can't talk, if all I can do is come in here and share this with you, he's leaving. Like, I tell him, like, this is what's going on. You know, I learned a whole lot about communication coming in here. I'm going to Florida. Let me tell you about this Florida trip and then I'm done. So, one of my sponsees is getting married. My sponsee is marrying one of my husband's sponsees. Like, there's no way to not go to this wedding in Florida. Okay? This is where it started. This wedding was supposed to be an elopement. In my head, she said elopement, and I'm thinking, okay, good, I get to plan the party for when they come back. Somewhere, elopement became destination wedding. Okay? All right. Then it's, but you have to come. And I said, I don't pull punches. I said, I'd love to come. I can't afford to come. Truth be told, I don't have the money on a whim to go to Florida. She tells a friend there's this whole thing. The next thing, like, there's cash in my hand to go to Florida. Not quite enough cash, but there's enough that I now can't say, well, we can't come. So this is my Florida trip. I'm leaving on Thursday. And I can't go to Florida and not visit my parents. Like, can't do that. So I'm leaving on Thursday. I'm getting to my parents' house at midnight. I'm spending Friday at my parents' house. I'm getting up Saturday morning to make the 5-hour drive to Key West to go to the wedding. I'm going to the wedding. I'm spending the night. I'm coming back to my parents on Sunday just in time to have dinner with them and go to sleep to get on a plane on Monday morning. So people are like, oh, how nice, you're going to Florida on vacation. I'm like, I'm going to Florida on a whirlwind. I wouldn't have it any other way. The relationships that I have and that kind of, and I want to go back to that idea of asking somebody when they ask me to sponsor them, what do they want from that relationship? And letting them be the guide to that relationship. So, and Desiree doesn't care that I tell this. So one of the things that drew Desiree to me is she too lost her mother when she was a teenager and has never had a mother. Even before her mother died, she didn't have a mother. So one of the things that she said as we had this discussion was, I need somebody to be my mother. I need somebody to teach me to do the things that I never learned to do. I need somebody who can show me what it's like to be a strong, respectful, respected woman. And I'm going to say that, like she said that, in like in my head, there's still a part of me that doesn't think that those adjectives describe me. I got to share with her and her baby's dad the birth of my grandson. That's what they say. I am his grandmother. I got to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 push while her right leg was pushing on my right shoulder. The choices that we make in here, the relationships that we can choose to have if we want them, are endless. If I had not lost the baby that I miscarried at 16, that baby would have been the exact age that Desiree is. So, can I attribute some meaning to things? Yes. I was given back what I thought was a gift that I lost. And in the relationship that we have together, she was given back a gift that she thought she lost. And nobody else has to see it that way, but I know today that I get to decide the meaning of things in my life. And you get to decide the meaning of things in your life today. And that's it. Thanks.
Thank you, ladies, so much for sharing.